from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In this hour, we'll take a look at the week ahead in Washington. The GOP tax bill is working its way through conference committee, but the road to reconciliation is a rocky one, and with the Christmas recess looming, can a deal be reached on the now extended debt limit? That plus the latest on the Alabama Senate race and more sexual misconduct allegations against high-profile political figures. But first, we'll get the latest on the devastating Thomas Fire in Southern California, the fifth largest in California history. It's coming up after this news. Welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. In this hour, we're going to be talking about the biggest political stories of the week, but first we're going to get an update on the Thomas Fire, the fifth largest in California history. The fire is now threatening the coastal communities of Carpinteria and Montecito, and Governor Jerry Brown surveyed the damage on Saturday in Ventura, where he linked worsening fires and a longer fire season to climate change.
This is the new normal. And this could be something that happens every year or every few years. It happens to some degree. It's just more intense, more widespread, and we're about ready to have firefighting at Christmas.
Carpinteria resident Maureen Claffey is a small business owner whose family has lived in and farmed in that community since 1860. She talked to KQED News yesterday after being forced to evacuate at 4 a.m.
We've never had anything like this. My grandfather's 95, and he's lived in the area his whole life as well. We're sixth-generation farmers here, and we've just never had fires come this close. We went to bed thinking things were fine and woke up to these emergency alerts and police officers at the door, so pretty scary.
Joining us now from Santa Barbara is Stephen Cuevas, Los Angeles Bureau Chief of KQED's The California Report. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Michael.
How do things look? What's your vantage point?
Things look a lot better than they have. The weather has been pretty favorable for firefighters overnight. These fierce winds that we've been experiencing across the Southland and here in Ventura, Santa Barbara County really didn't kind of manifest themselves last night as expected. Right now, I'm in Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, and it's still. The weather's cool. This has really helped the firefighters start to get some sort of handle on this thing. They're definitely not feeling like they're out of the woods. There could be significant winds later today, and that can always shift things. I think firefighters have been saying this fire has done everything we didn't think it was going to do and everything we thought it was going to do. It hasn't.
They must be exhausted at this point.
I would imagine everyone is. You know, I was in Carpinteria, which you mentioned last night, and the neighborhoods that were under evacuation order were pretty calm. Folks were around. It seemed pretty clear a lot of people had left. But, yeah, I would say it's exhausting. Just being in this weather with so much smoke blanketing the area, it's really fatiguing. I can only imagine the effect this has had on people for 8 days.
What do we know now, or do we know, in terms of containment numbers and acreage?
This thing's burned through roughly 230,000 acres. I would imagine that's going to be updated soon. Just in the last, I think, 48 hours as it took off to the west into Santa Barbara County, it chewed up another 50,000. So that's where we are with acreage. We're talking about 600-plus homes destroyed, many more damaged, and about 18,000 threatened. Though I think, and this is everyone's hoping this, that things will be fairly stable over the next 24, 48 hours.
Let us hope, indeed, that that's the case. And thank you for all your good work down there. I appreciate it, Stephen.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Stephen Cuevas, who is Los Angeles Bureau Chief with the California Report, and we will continue to update you and get into that more right now, as well as the news of the week with National Public Radio's Domenico Montanaro. And good morning, Domenico.
Hey there.
Domenico Montanaro is lead editor for politics and digital audience with National Public Radio. We also want to welcome Franco Ordonez. Franco Ordonez is White House correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers, and welcome to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And let me begin, actually, with Domenico. we can jump right off of this for a moment and talk about the tax bill, because there's a lot of slashing of essentially what would be, well, deductible for not only fires, but I think we're talking about, well, let's get into it with you, Domenico. I mean, at this point, there is some talk about losses not being essentially deductible from this sort of thing that we're experiencing now down in Southern California.
Well, they're trying to squeeze in this tax bill into these reconciliation rules, which is these special budget rules, in order to be able to get 50 votes or 51 votes rather than having to go the 60 route, so to overcome a filibuster. So when you wind up doing that, you wind up having to squeeze in a whole bunch of things that you might not necessarily love doing or want to do because you're trying to make the numbers work. And they can't exceed $1.5 trillion in exploding the deficit. So the right now they're stuck inside that number and would be able to pass this if they can reconcile the House and Senate bills by not going over that $1.5 trillion number.
Well, there is, I think, some talk about eliminating uncovered losses, and that would be essentially the sort of thing we're experiencing now in Southern California, unless it's there's a declaration of a federal disaster. And Franco Ordonez, what else is being worked on in this reconciliation? I mean, they've got Susan Collins saying, well, they're going to presumably keep their promises to her about health care, but there's lots of stuff up for grabs. There's even, I think, the 20% up for grabs, do you renegotiate?
I think the 20%, I mean, I think everything, you know, kind of is still in flux. I think the 20%, I think they seem to be not wanting to go below that. Certainly the House is certainly saying we're not going to negotiate more. Some have talked about changing that, but I think they're pretty solid on the 20%.
Well, what, you know, there's a question looming over this. I want to get more into the tax bill, but you have to ask, why now? I mean, why this tax cut now, with the economy growing, with a fairly good labor market, with near full employment and sort of good consumer credits going?
Well, I mean, I think there's a few reasons, but one, I think the big one is this is something that President Trump campaigned on. This is something that he really feels is a potential legacy matter, and they really, really need a victory here. The Republicans, they've had major challenges getting big wins aside from the Supreme Court justice. They've struggled in so many different areas, as Domenico could tell you. But the tax bill is something that they feel like now they are, you know, coming to an end. You know, certainly there's still a lot of hurdles, but this is something where they feel they can get a victory on, and they feel they have to in many ways.
Is it fait accompli, Domenico? Or, again, there's a lot of talk about getting DACA in this and all of that.
They're not going to probably get DACA in this, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The Democrats are trying to get something done on the DREAM Act to get students who have been in the United States, kids who were brought here for a long time, to be part of what's known as the omnibus spending bill. So that's separate from this tax bill, but would probably wind up having to pass around the same time. So, you know, Republicans are trying to avoid kind of a lump of coal in the stocking this year, but they've backloaded everything to kind of be done by Christmas, because December 8th was when the tax bill, when the government funding bill needed to be extended. Otherwise, they would run out of funding and you'd have a government shutdown. That was pushed off 2 weeks. So now the Friday before Christmas, you're looking at Republicans trying to pass a giant spending bill, which very well could include some element of the DREAM Act, which Democrats are trying to push for. But at the same time, some of the conditions on the DREAM Act that have been going through, Democrats find odious. And, you know, the tax bill, for all intents and purposes, is fait accompli, but they haven't still ironed out some of the details. They were hoping to have that done last week. And if they, you know, keep dawdling on it and aren't able to get it done this week, it makes it much more difficult to get it done by Christmas.
Well, let's talk about that two-week work stop gap. I mean, it averts a shutdown now. It goes through the 22nd of December. We seem to face this every single year. But the majority of Democrats are opposed, and the Freedom Caucus wanted this past December 22nd, correct?
Yeah, the Freedom Caucus wanted this, wanted it out of the way. Well, they want these things out of the way generally, you know. But the thing is, Congress has been dealing with the sexual harassment allegations over a lot of members. One of the Freedom Caucus members just resigned from the House, effective Friday, Trent Franks from Arizona. So you've got a lot of different fires burning on Capitol Hill right now. But you're right that they don't generally get a budget negotiated and passed. And that's why you wind up with these stopgap short-term spending measures that run every 3 to 4 months or so, and that looks like what they're going to be heading toward again.
And Franco, you've got Nancy Pelosi say she won't leave without a DACA, some sort of DACA resolution, and you got 20 House Republicans, I believe, behind protecting DACA.
It's true. You have a lot of momentum. I was talking with some of the business groups that are pushing for a DACA, telling me how they feel like they have never seen such momentum for DACA on both sides, or for protecting DACA and the Dreamers, than they ever have before. The challenge is what kind of Domenico put forth is, like, there's so many fires on Capitol Hill. And as we all know, unless the issue is at the very tippy top of the agenda, sometimes it's really tough to get anything accomplished. The Democrats recognize that there are other issues involved, and it's unclear whether it's unclear whether they're going to be able to keep the momentum going. Certainly, Nancy Pelosi says she is willing to go the whole route. There are definitely Democrats who say, hey, let's allow the Democrats to try to, you know, fund the budget without us. And if they can do it, they can do it. But if they can't, then they're going to need, we're going to have some conditions, and DACA is one of them. We'll see if that kind of carries the day. We've spoken with Democratic leaders who are saying, you know, it is possibly not the top agenda, so I'm not so sure it's going to happen now. You also have the challenge with DACA that the deadline is actually in March. Now, the advocates will tell you that people are already starting to lose their work permits. But again, this Congress likes to do things on deadline, so that momentum could be, at least the other side can make the argument that, you know, we don't have to do it now.
Franco Ordonez, again, is White House correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. He's with us along with Domenico Montanaro, who is lead editor for politics and digital audience with NPR. There are some big divisions, though, and let's just talk about this for a moment with you, Domenico, between, well, what the Democrats obviously want to spend and what the Republicans do, particularly with military spending. But we're also talking about the next couple of years in terms of priorities, disaster relief, for example, or whether money should be going to Puerto Rico, or stabilization of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, there's a lot that's on the line here.
Certainly. But, you know, elections do have consequences. Republicans are in charge of both the House and Senate and the presidency. And that is something that I've been saying for a long time. And when Democrats argue with each other about who's, you know, most progressive or most centrist, or who's a sellout or who's not, you know, when you are stuck out of power, the other party gets to make a lot of the decisions. And that's kind of what has happened here. You know, there are, though, I mean, when you mention the disaster relief, fires, Puerto Rico, there is a bigger discussion that's maybe should be taking place about climate change at this point, because, you know, there is going to need to be more of this kind of funding, a lot of experts warn. And you're seeing even Republicans in California and elsewhere, Jeff Denham, for example, who are saying that, you know, there are going to have to be different ways to deal with disaster relief, and because there is probably going to be more money increasingly over the years that's going to need to be applied for.
There's also, I should mention, a division in all this between hurricanes and wildfires. There have been 58,000 wildfires of about 1 million acres, and we're talking about probably only a few of those under the Senate bill available for taxpayer relief. But let me get to what else is going on in a major way. We've got the Roy Moore election up for grabs tomorrow, and we've also got accusers just today going forward demanding that Congress investigate President Trump's alleged sexual harassment. Let's talk about what's going on in Alabama first, if we may, with you, Franco. I mean, President Obama, I was wondering where he was in all this, and he put out a call, and it was just a call that really backs Doug Jones. It's not necessarily a call that excoriates against his opponent or anything along those lines, like we've been hearing from President Trump talking about if Doug Jones is elected, everything will crash down. in terms of his agenda. What kind of effect are we going to have, do you think, not only from President Obama entering this, but Senator Shelby, the other senator, Republican senator from Alabama, saying he is not going to vote for Roy Moore?
I think Senator Shelby's comments this weekend were very significant. Senator Shelby's obviously the senior senator of Alabama. He's conservative. He's very popular. He is not someone who goes on television a lot, and speaks out and is in the everyday conversation as some other members. I think this was very strategic in that he came out, just a couple days before the election to have some influence on this election. This is not something where he was, caught off guard in the bowels of the Capitol. I think it's just fair to say or safe to say that he knew this question was coming, and he had something to say, and he wanted to say it. And he said it very significantly that he didn't vote for Roy Moore. He wouldn't vote for Roy Moore. And he thinks that the Republican Party could do better.
Well, what about the president urging Alabamans to vote for Roy Moore and really coming out strong as he did in Pensacola, Florida?
He did. Talk about kind of a change in conversation, a change in tone from just a few weeks ago, where it really seemed like he was backing off of endorsing it. And just the past 2 days, he has really jumped out forward and is completely backing Roy Moore. You mentioned the comments in Pensacola where he's telling people that that the people of Alabama need to vote for Roy Moore because they need to support him. He's certainly painting this as a vote for him, for his party. If you're a Moore supporter or a Trump supporter, you see this kind of as a chance to ratify conservative values, a chance to protect Donald Trump's agenda. On the flip side, others see this as, I'd say kind of a vote, against kind of racial politics.
Domenico Montanaro, this is a president, it's almost needless to say, who hates losing under any circumstances. He lost with his backing of Luther Strange. If he loses with Roy Moore, I suspect it will be taken as a pretty serious defeat. But let's assume for the moment that Roy Moore comes out ahead in this race and actually wins the senatorial race in Alabama. Then we face a kind of ethics investigation, don't we, for one thing, and the Senate doesn't have to seat him.
Well, a Moore win certainly puts Republicans in a pickle. Do they want to move to expel the senator, the grassroots just picked, and possibly cause an uprising in the base? Do they let him stay and cede any claim to moral leadership on sexual harassment and assault? I mean, are they ready to accept being the party of sexual harassment and assault? I mean, maybe it decides yes because it already went there electing Trump, who had more than a dozen women file complaints against him. They can try and dismiss the allegations as politically driven and old and hoping that the culture war is again bait for Democrats. And that's something that Democrats have to be concerned about too, because it is something that fires up the Democratic base. Instead of talking out against the tax bill or health care or about how they plan to bring back a fairer economy, for example, that works for everyone, as the Democratic National Committee likes to put it, Democrats are in danger of repeating 2016, running against Trump and right smack into the culture war lane.
Well, Senator Al Franken, of course, has resigned in the wake of sexual allegations, and three women who have accused President Trump of sexual harassment are actually asking Congress to investigate the allegations against him. They held a press conference today, in fact, demanding that the president be held accountable for his actions. Is this going to go anywhere, do you think, Domenico?
Well, it's sort of difficult to say because you have the president and the White House reacting and responding and saying that this is something that was litigated by the election in 2016. You don't have Republicans in Congress very eager or willing to want to open up some kind of congressional investigation into the president's conduct. So as much attention as it gets, it's going to wind up being from people speaking out, from, like these women are coming out and talking about it, and media reports or giving the women a platform to speak out again, because I don't think there's going to be any kind of sanctioned official investigation from Congress.
Talking about the Alabama Senate race, also talking about the concerns over government shutdown and about the tax bill. And if you have questions or if you have comments and would like to just join the conversation, questions about anything we're talking about, we certainly welcome your involvement in the program. And let me tell you how you can become a part of it. You can join us right now toll-free at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Please feel free to join us now at 866-733-6786. You can also post your questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, or you can go to our or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Talking with Domenico Montanaro, who is lead editor for politics and digital audience with NPR, and Franco Ordonez, who is White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers and also co-host of the podcast Majority Minority. And again, we want to hear from you, our listeners, so please feel free to add your voice to this conversation or any questions or comments you might have. Let me go back, Franco, to you just on a question of where you think this is going to move in terms of the tax bill at this point with reconciliation. We're assuming that everything's going to move through, that they're going to be able to make the adjustments. And as I said, Susan Collins believes that they will definitely go along with her expressed wishes. But a lot is still up for grabs and a lot of still seems to be under negotiation.
A lot certainly seems to be under negotiation. There are so many, hurdles. You got the state and local tax breaks. You got the income tax breaks. You got all these, you got drilling in the Arctic. You have a lot of conflicts that are going to pit special interest groups together. That said, Mark Meadows, he's the head of the Freedom Caucus, the group of hardcore conservatives, feels like it's nothing that they can overcome. You pointed Susan Collins, feels that they can get it done. We'll see where it ends up. But, the clock is certainly ticking. They certainly want to have a deal. Many feel they need to have a deal. And, in regards to Trump's backing of all this, Trump certainly wants to have a deal. And many will tell you that Trump doesn't necessarily care as much about what those specific deals are, but he wants the deal. He wants to be able to claim this as a victory.
Well, we're also seeing a number of GOP lawmakers, about a half dozen, demanding a new investigating of the Mueller team. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that. Certainly, conservative media has really been almost flailing at Mueller and saying he should be fired. There seems to be, at least on the right, some kind of groundswell here. What do you think, Domenico?
I think that this is a key piece of trying to muddy up the Mueller investigation, given that it's focusing on President Trump, reportedly. Looking at these 18 days that Michael Flynn remained in the White House from the time that Sally Yates, then the acting attorney general, went to the White House counsel, Don McGahn, and said, this man has been compromised, something should be done about it, and nothing happened. So they want to know what the president knew, when he knew it, and what they were prepared to do about it.
And we want to hear from you, our listeners. Again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and you can also post any questions or comments you might have onto our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum, and this is our Monday morning news roundup. We're talking with Domenico Montanaro, who is lead editor for politics and digital audience with National Public Radio, and Franco Ordonez, who is White House correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. And you, if you would indeed care to join us, we invite you to do that. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. I wanted to ask you, if I could, before we move to callers, Franco, if we have any sense of the polling down in Alabama. I mean, there's certainly... at this point, one has to wonder, even though there's some lead for Doug Jones, how reliable and how valid those polls are.
Yeah, as we've learned in the past, polling can be suspect. But yes, there has been a lot of polling done, even recently. Polling, it seems like every day, or even every hour, a new poll will come out and showing a different side. A Fox poll just came out today showing, I believe, Doug Jones ahead. Another poll, Roy Moore. I think in the average of the polls, though, Roy Moore still has a few point lead in the average, it's going to be a very close race. It really is like it's a horse race, and each person can be ahead at any moment. Both sides are raising questions about the polls that don't show them ahead. You know, we spoke with one Democratic operative last week who was saying just to be in this position is a minor miracle, which kind of shows how this was so expected to be a slam dunk for Republicans.
And before I bring our callers into this, quick question for you, Domenico. We had a subway bombing, a pipe bombing earlier this morning in New York City. Fortunately, there were some injuries, no deaths. I say fortunately because it could have been far worse, but it was apparently low-tech kind of a bomb. Somebody from Bangladesh has been arrested and claimed to be doing this for ISIS. What do we know?
Yeah, it was a Bangladeshi native, a man named Akayed Ullah, who detonated part of this low-tech explosive device close to the bus terminal at 42nd Street and 8th Avenue in New York, which is close to Port Authority in New York. And three people sustained some minor injuries. Police said they had ringing in their ears or headaches. But the video, certainly very scary. You watch the man blow himself up, essentially. He sustained injuries, but I believe is alive and taken to the hospital. But you see him fall down and you realize how bad or how devastating, how deadly this could have been. And certainly New Yorkers relieved that it wasn't worse. And of course, this comes only a couple weeks after the person drove the truck on the west side into a crowd of bicyclists, killing several people. So, you know, New York is consistently a target, and as we've seen over the years since 9/11, but luckily today's wasn't as bad as it could have been.
Yeah, and hats off to the Port Authority law enforcement and to the police, who acted very quickly, from what I understand, and expeditiously. Mm-hmm. Let me bring some of our callers into this conversation. Let's go to you, Brad, first. Good morning.
Good morning. So I had a quick question about the reconciliation of the tax bill, and that was, does it require a revote by both houses? And if it doesn't, what would trigger a revote? Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the question. Domenico?
I do believe it does require another vote by both houses, but they can't make any changes. So if they make any change or try to make any amendments to that, then they would all have to kind of get together and reconcile that bill once again.
And let me thank the caller and go to another caller, and that's you, Susan. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Michael. If these proposed tax cuts go through, what effect will they have on Medicare, Medi-Cal, Social Security? I don't hear anything. I don't read anything about the impact.
Well, the impact, we've been talking about it. The impact is down the line, probably, Franco, one can assume, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't speak to those. I'm not a healthcare reporter, and some of that is beyond my limit. But, you know, certainly the Senate bill would, you know, repeal many aspects of the Affordable Care Act. You know, it would most people pay in a penalty if they don't purchase health care. I don't know. I'd like to maybe flip this over to Domenico, if I could, or you. This is not necessarily my area.
Yeah, well, it's Domenico, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think the big thing here is that Democrats are looking at a comment that Paul Ryan made, the Speaker of the House, on a conservative talk radio show, where he said, we're going to have to get back next year at entitlement reform, which is how you tackle the debt and deficit. So ironically, the Republican tax bills would increase the deficit by $1.5 trillion. And because that deficit would be going up, they're saying that they're going to have to make successive cuts later to Medicare and Medicaid, presumably.
And other entitlements. I mean, that's what they've been after. But let me go back to what I mentioned before about Susan Collins. She doesn't want any cuts for federal Medicare payments, and she also has said that she wants support for two separate health care bills that would lower premiums. So that's what she feels is the promise to her. That's what she feels the conference committee will allow for, and that's why she's on board. But again, if that is squishy, it may mean something very different, at least as far as her vote is concerned. And this is only a couple of votes that we're talking about.
Yeah, and Collins is somebody who also doesn't want to see the mandate repealed, but she got assurances that they would have discussions about continuing these CSRs, the cost-sharing subsidies, to remain in place for at least the short term so that people wouldn't see their premiums explode.
And I'll read a comment from Rosie here who says, Paul Ryan is determined to cut Medicare and Social Security if this tax bill passes. He plans to cut both programs. There is not enough news outlets discussing these important issues. And indeed, we've been making every effort to do that. But I think the caller is, Rosie is correct about this, just as you've sort of outlined, Domenico. And indeed, if you have something to add to this conversation, we do welcome your calls. Toll free, 866-733-6786. There's a listener who wants to know about children's health bill. Can you sort of flesh that out a little bit for us, Domenico Montanaro?
Well, there is another deadline to try to reauthorize the Children's Health Insurance Bill, or CHIP, and it is something that they've struggled, ironically or oddly, because this is something both sides agree they need to continue doing. But it's going to be a big part of the debate when it comes not only to the tax bill, and not likely the happening with regard to the tax bill, but perhaps with the omnibus spending bill toward December 22nd.
And let me go back, if I may, Franco, to you. Again, Franco Ordonez is a White House correspondent from McClatchy and is also co-host of the podcast Majority Minority. There is a minority now that seems to be, well, after the Mueller investigation, as I alluded to before we went to the break, and actually feeling as if, I don't know how else to put it, as if he has to go.
Yeah, I mean, I would just, you know, echo what some of the thoughts that Domenico said earlier, that, you know, there is a definite strategic effort to undercut the, you know, the credibility of the Mueller investigation. I think there are definitely conservatives on the far right who I think see this as a threat. Certainly the Trump administration sees this as a threat, and they are doing what they can to confront this. You know, this is obviously a very important legal issue. There is also a battle in the court of public opinion, and some feel that battle may be even a greater fight for the Trump administration and Trump. This is, you know, you have both his allies and the administration kind of pushing back in any way and every way they can, even with the recent, you know, questions about collusion and these different emails that have gone out about whether he knew or didn't know about the FBI when he fired Comey. You know, there's a lot of questions left to be answered, and there's certainly a big push by supporters to undercut this investigation.
Well, it's ironic in light of the fact that Bob Mueller is not only a card-carrying Republican, but certainly a man who has been always identified with integrity. But I think it's safe to say that the Manafort, the action against Paul Manafort and the action also against Michael Flynn have set a lot of this off. But also something about a guy named Pete Stroke, who was an FBI investigator and who sent out some anti-Trump texts and was moved down to or demoted to a lower position within the Mueller investigation. There's been a good deal of hay made out of that. Franco?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it goes to that point. I mean, I think they're looking for any opportunity and any avenue to undercut this investigation. It's not unlike some of the efforts that the administration or you know Trump himself has made against the media and making arguments that any little thing is an example of an agenda against him.
Here's William, who says, I said, why a tax bill now? Same question is being asked about Jerusalem as the capital. But this listener says, because donors want a payday now or they will make no payments in next year's races. Let me get some more of your calls on here. Let me go to Bill. Bill, you're on.
Oh, hello. It seemed to me that one of the major objections to the original bill, I think in bullet form, certainly out of the Senate, was the sunsetting of the middle-class tax benefits after 6 or 7 years, I guess because that was necessary in order to keep the deficit from ballooning any further. But that seems like it ought to make any reconciliation bill pretty objectionable to a politician who wants to be in office beyond 6 or 7 years from now. Is that likely to survive the conference?
Yeah, let me go to you, Domenico. Domenico Montanaro.
Well, you know, President Trump has this expression that you just say it and people will believe it. You put it out there and people believe it. So, you know, the point of this is that, yes, there was a lot of discussion about the fact that these middle class tax cuts, the individual rate cuts, are temporary as opposed to the corporate tax cuts, which are permanent. So moving the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20% and having sort of these marginal middle class tax cuts. The conceit behind this is that almost nobody ever lets taxes increase, you know, like even when President Obama came into office and certainly had a very different economic view than President Bush did, those Bush tax cuts were not allowed to just expire. They were re-upped. So what Republicans are doing as sort of a tax gimmick, frankly, a numbers gimmick, is to say, well, you know, we'll gamble on the fact that nobody is going to want to be tagged as a future president as saying that they raised your taxes. So they'll probably re-up them anyway and it won't count toward our scorecard.
How does the alternative minimum tax figure in all this, Domenico?
Oh, boy. The alternative minimum tax. It's a piece of it. You know, the AMT.
It's a piece of work, as we would say, yeah.
Well, the AMT originally came into play because only 155 people paid taxes. I'm sorry, there were 155 very wealthy people who paid zero in taxes. And members of Congress said that they actually got more letters in the 1960s about these 155 people who paid no taxes than the Vietnam War. So whether that's true or not, I don't know. But that's what they were saying. So that's why they wound up putting the AMT in place. The problem is that the AMT was never indexed for inflation. So more and more people continued to get hurt by it or continued to have to pay taxes under it if you were wealthy. And that bar kept getting lower and lower. So that is part of the discussion here, and it could be repealed or eliminated. There are different sets of rules with the House and the Senate. The House, I think, would eliminate it completely, and the Senate sets a date for when it would expire.
Again, Domenico Montanaro is lead editor for Politics and Digital Audience with NPR, and let me get to more of your calls. Let's go next to Jim. Jim, join us.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for the discussion. I'm really wondering where the Democratic leadership is. I was listening to the passage of the Senate bill, the Senate passing a tax bill, and the only thing I heard Schumer say on PBS was he hadn't read the bill. There's just so much at stake, not only for the so-called blue states, but the whole country, and I'm just not hearing it. I don't know why isn't there an uproar?
Where's the uproar?
I don't know what's going on.
I think. Can I go to you, Franco?
Sure. I mean, I would say there's a large uproar from the Democrats.
Yeah.
When the Senate bill was passed, you know, late, you know, at 2 a.m., there were, you know, YouTube videos and Twitter of pictures of the handwritten changes.
The scrawls.
Yeah, the scrawls that were being made on the bill. I mean, I think there is, you know, a big group united behind this effort. At the same time, I think they also see the writing on the wall that, you know, this is something they have, you know, limited power. As you know, they do not control the Senate. They do not control the House. They do not control the White House. So there's only so much they can do. So they face challenges, but they are certainly making as much of an effort to say that, you know, the American people, in their words, are being ripped off by this effort. And as Domenico pointed out, you know, the tax cuts for the corporates, and in many for middle class and lower income individuals having to pay higher taxes.
Well, here's Laura, who asks, how much real power or influence will the five Democrats on the conference committee have, being outnumbered by seven Republicans? Franco?
I think that's a great question. I mean, I think their power is going to be very limited. I mean, this is a party, a Republican leadership that has been okay with pushing forward their agenda without the support of Democrats. Sometimes they say they are using, you know, Democrats as a tool, calling them obstructionists. I think they're pretty much ready and willing and able to do what they can without them. That said, you know, Trump certainly has made some inroads. There are Democrats who are up for re-election in states that Trump won that they may want to pull over with some of these different initiatives. The Republicans, I feel, are pretty comfortable kind of, you know, pushing their weight and using their elbows to get what they want.
And Franco Ordonez, again, is White House correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers, also co-host of the podcast Majority Minority. Did you want to say something here, Domenico Montanaro?
Yeah, I was just going to, you know, say that, you know, seven is more than five. And frankly, that's what Republicans have been working on, the operating idea that, well, if they have the numbers, then they're going to pass it on their own. If they don't have the numbers, then maybe they'll reach out. But that has not been the modus operandi at this point for any of the Republican leadership or President Trump.
Well, we're also, you talk about the executive and the legislature, there's also a good deal of concern that's coming from Democrats and from those, let's say, who are in opposition to the Trump administration, or for that matter to a GOP majority, a good deal of concern about all of the federal judgeships that are open that are going to be replaced. And not only that, but talk about, well, when President Trump was saying the FBI is in tatters and being very critical about investigative institutions, about creating literally something else, and now putting possibly Mike Pompeo in head of the CIA. I mean, there's lots that's in motion here, Domenico.
Yeah, and the president's going to be speaking at the FBI Academy this week as well. So that should be it could be wind up being like a CIA moment from early in his presidency. So yeah, there's a lot there, he has definitely put in a lot of people in a lot of these agencies who are sort of expressly against the missions of those agencies. If you think about Scott Pruitt at the EPA, for example, or you think about you know, anybody else really in a lot of the places where even people he tried to put in place. So, you know, I mean...
Rick Perry? And,
well, Rick Perry, who didn't know that the Energy Agency dealt with nuclear stuff beforehand, but I'm thinking about Mick Mulvaney more specifically when he went over to now also not just be in charge of OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, but also the CFPB, which, you know, is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So he's spoken out against it, saying that it was a pretty bad agency, that it didn't like how it was set up and all that. And now he's in charge of it. So you have a lot of people who are in charge of these agencies who the president has entrusted because they don't trust what the government workers who buy into these missions want to do with them.
Well, when I said things are in motion, though, I mean, there's talk not only about Rex Tillerson leaving and probably being replaced by Mike Pompeo. There's also talk about Gary Cohen leaving. And we've just seen, in fact, one of Trump's major advisors leave.
Dina Powell.
Dina Powell. Thank you.
Yeah.
Ron has a good question here. If the government is shut down, does the tax bill go down and the reconciliation process is no longer applicable, Domenico?
Well, no. I mean, they'll probably just bring it back up again in the reconciliation process again if they want to go that route. You know, it's hard for me to really understand why they wouldn't try. As you know, has been noted that there are lots of Democrats who could potentially sign on to this kind of tax bill. Why you wouldn't start with some kind of gang, you know, Gang of Eight or whatever. I know gangs are out now when it comes to Congress. But if they could start with a bunch of those bipartisan, if they could start with a bipartisan group, people like Joe Manchin, Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Donnelly, these are all people who would feel a lot of pressure to have to work with Republicans and this president. So for the president and the Republican leadership not to try to leverage them just seems like a missed opportunity.
I don't want to miss an opportunity to read some comments that are coming in here. Let me read a few, and then I'll go to more of your calls. Kyle writes, considering all of these officials have resigned, why do we not hold our own president to the same standards? And Bill writes, it's astounding. Republicans are voted into office considering their assault on the poor and middle class. Why do Americans keep sending them to Washington? And Darrow writes, if it became evident that the president and Congress were completely mutually corrupt and that Congress refused to impeach for any criminal act by president and his party, no matter how treasonous, then what could the American people do to stop them? Want to comment on that, Franco?
You know, I mean, what they can do is they can vote President Trump out in 2020. It's going to be, you know, for him to be impeached with Republicans' control and power, it's going to be a high bar. I think that's safe to say. Certainly, there is a segment of the United States, of the voting public, that is extremely dissatisfied with. You know, with the direction that Trump has taken the country, the, you know, efforts that he has made to change things. But we also must remember, despite low poll numbers, among Republicans, Trump still has very strong support, over 80% among Republicans. So for a big swath of the country, he has a lot of support. And as politics are today, and certainly as Trump is taking the strategic, you know, his strategy is to speak to his base, and the efforts that he's done, the initiative that he's taken on, are things that have resonated with his base.
That base still remains about 32% of the American people, which, you know, is not necessarily high numbers when you look historically. When you look historically, what's fascinating is there have been two impeachments, of course, recently. One was against Richard Nixon. It was in a Democratic Congress. He was a Republican. The other was against Bill Clinton. It was with a Republican Congress, and he was a Democrat. So what you say certainly resonates, but there seems to be also some concern about the possibility of invoking the 25th Amendment here that's coming from the right, as if the right is some on the right who are Trump supporters are saying that this will be used, if not Mueller trying to essentially dismantle the Trump administration. Some thoughts about that from you, Domenico?
If Mueller's trying to dismantle the Trump administration?
Well, no, I think they're saying that's what they're saying now on Fox News and the like, that he's clearly trying to undo that they're trying to do from the left and from the Democratic Party, the Trump administration, and take away his mandate. But there also is a good deal of talk of the 25th Amendment being invoked here, from the right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that I don't know that any of these sort of, I don't know what to call them, but the sort of outlandish schemes to revoke amendments or put new amendments in place or impeach the president or any of that is likely to take place. You know, these are things that might get talked about, but they're not things that really leadership is looking to act upon. At the same time, there's absolutely this effort underway to try to undermine Mueller, as we've talked about, and that is, you know, as consequential or more consequential than talk of potential amendments, because that is something that they're actually able to enact. It's almost like they're able to lay the groundwork right now before people go home for Christmas to be able to say, here are the arguments, here are the talking points, here's how it should go around your dinner table.
If you listen to some of the commentators on Fox News, especially people like Sean Hannity, you would come to believe that the Mueller investigation is really out and designed to essentially supplant or get removal of President Trump, and that is its kind of monomaniacal purpose. But let me get to some more of our callers here. Let's get Tom on next. And Tom, join us. You're on.
Yes. Good morning. I have a question about why states are always going to the federal government for money. And their requests for Medicare and Medicaid and Medi-Cal, especially Medi-Cal, there are no limits to what the states can demand from the federal government for poor people, disadvantaged, legal immigrants, and illegal aliens. Why is it that that states don't raise money? As I understand it, in Europe, the federal governments are not demanded. The provinces, the cantons, and others supply a certain percentage of money to take care of their own poor people. Secondly, Michael, why do you always dominate the conversation? I've been waiting 20 minutes to ask this call. This is not the Michael Krasny show. It's the KQED Forum. Why don't you allow the people to ask questions and make their comments rather than you talking so much all of the time?
Sorry you feel that way. I'm glad you got through and asked your questions, including that one. But let me go, if I may, to the heart of what you wanted to have answered first before your criticism. Domenico Montanaro is asking about state power, really.
Yeah, there's a couple of things on this. You know, a lot of states have balanced budget amendments, so it's impossible for the states to be able to say, to go back to their constituents and taxpayers and say, we want to turn the spigot a little bit here and say that you should pay a little bit more money, and then, then that means that they're going to have to go back to their legislatures and make cuts elsewhere. Now, the caller may very well feel that that's what should be done, and maybe he's getting to the larger point that maybe this has to do more with blue states. But a lot of the blue states, and, you know, you could talk to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo about this, they're smarting over the fact that this SALT, state and local tax deductions, are being eliminated in some form or another, or minimized, depending on, you know, who gets what out of the Senate or House bills, because one area where he's pretty upset is the fact that New York winds up paying more money than they bring back. So they're already a big donor state.
Well, we'll conclude, and I want to thank both of you. This is called Forum with Michael Krasny, but it was good to have both of you aboard here. We talked earlier with Stephen Cuevas of the California Report. Franco Ordonez, thank you for being with us. Franco Ordonez is the White House correspondent for the McClatchy Newspapers, and Domenico Montanaro, again, is lead editor for Politics and Digital Audience with NPR. Up ahead, we're going to talk with Andy Weir, who has a new book out. He had a book that had a great deal of success, was made into a movie called The Martian. He's got a new one out. It's all about colonies on the moon. We'll find out about the science that he's done on that, as well as the novel. Stay tuned for that. It's up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.